This from a House Republican this afternoon is some not so bad advice.
It's a good idea for everybody to go home, get some rest, calm down a little bit, think, don't react emotionally.
On a Friday, a crazy, crazy Friday from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 24th of March, 2017. Good as always to have you along, everybody. 7 years and a day after the Affordable Care Act became law, after more than 50 votes to repeal and replace it, and 24 hours of high-tension politics later, it is done. We will leave the political postmortems to others and focus here on what today's demise of the American Health Care Act means for the economic future. Lee Gallagher's at Fortune Magazine. She's in New York. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. He is in our studios in Washington. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai. Hi, Kai.
So, Sudeep, as I heard on the CNN analysis of this whole thing this afternoon, healthcare has been the organizing principle for the GOP and its resistance for the past, like, 10 years almost. What can we glean, then, from where we go from here, from its demise?
We can glean that the GOP had an organizing principle on politics, on how to rally people, how to put on a hat, how to get people together in a crowd, how to get them energized. But governing is a different thing. And we've seen a stream of Republicans come out today and acknowledge that it was a lot easier when we weren't actually the party in power to just say things and see that they'll happen. And obviously, in this case, when you have to come up with the hard details that are going to upset a lot of people from various factions, let alone the American people, just talking about the industry factions,
right.
That's too hard enough. And then when you bring the real personal effects of healthcare onto this, game over.
Lee, as Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, said this afternoon after the bill was pulled, he said, in essence, we're going to have some growing pains, and you saw it here today. He also said, we're going to move on now. We're going to move to tax reform. We're going to move to infrastructure. We're going to move to controlling the deficit. Is any of that easier now that health care has gone down, or is it harder, or what happens?
No, I mean, it's faster.
Yeah, it's quicker. You get there faster, right? Yeah.
Right away. But I think the big concern here is that, you know, this really shows that these divisions in the party may make it, you know, really difficult to get anything done. And I think that it's interesting that the markets were closed when this all went down. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens Monday. I mean, we already saw this week the market feeling really the concerns that this was maybe not going to happen. And I think that, you know, Wall Street is just desperately waiting. Business is desperately waiting for all these pro-growth policies that the president kept talking about to be turned into action. This puts all that in doubt at a time when the market, many people say, it's already overvalued.
Well, Sudeep, just real briefly, another detour into the markets here. They have been waiting for all of this stuff to come. It now appears that the Republicans, even though they control political Washington, cannot deliver. What do you suppose happens on Monday? Because the market reaction today was, I mean, everybody knew this was happening, and everybody on Wall Street was like, meh.
The people on Wall Street, investors have been willing to look the other way for a while. So it depends on how quickly Republicans can regroup and put the public sight on taxes and what kind of numbers they're talking about. But nothing brings out the knives of corporate America like corporate tax battle.
Right.
So it nothing. And so good luck getting a comprehensive bill that's going to lower rates and change the entire tax system for the first time in 30-something years. That doesn't happen in this way with this kind of environment.
Lee, a word here about the president of the United States as a businessman and as a man who prides himself on the art of the deal. He said today, after 10 days of this bill, maybe 2.5 weeks, he said, it's time enough, time to move on, we're done with this. What does this say about his fundamental campaign promise, which is, I can close the deal?
Well, it's funny, as I was standing in the lobby waiting to come up here today, these two guys walked in, took one look at the TV on the screen and saw the headline and just sort of shrugged, as New Yorkers do, and said, so much for the art of the deal. And I think that is exactly it. And I think, you know, I think it's interesting. I mean, you could see how President Trump could spin this. You know, I pulled it. I knew it wasn't going to happen. This is decisive. This is what happens in business. You can just see how this is going to happen. He didn't really see coming that he was going to blame the Democrats, but that's another thing.
Yeah.
But, you know,
Sudeep,
the other funny tweet.
Yeah,
tweet was, Siri, how many times did the House vote to repeal Obamacare? I just was keeping track of all the fun tweets that are out there today because you have
Twitter's
to have a little humor about it.
Sudeep, same basic question then, negotiating skills wise, about the Speaker of the House, who now, after having had this failure, has to carry all of those things he mentioned today, tax reform and infrastructure and deficit and all of that jazz. His caucus is not behind him.
It is not behind him. God, I remember when Paul Ryan had the power of personality behind him. Everyone thought he was the hot new thing. Right. He would change everything. Everyone thought Donald Trump might be able to use his power of personality. Yeah. This really points to a more fundamental problem. It's the splintered politics. When you can't control your party on something so fundamental, so basic that you've been rallying around for 7 years, how can you control them around anything else? That's the wake-up call that investors are going to have to confront on Monday. How do you deal with something that isn't really about Barack Obama being the problem of being able to connect? It's really something more fundamental in our political system right now.
Sadeep Reddy at Politico and Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have a nice weekend. Wall Street Today was a whole lot of nothing given, you know, all the rest of it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Before the health care bill was pulled today, President Trump had a signing ceremony in the Oval Office, a construction permit for the long-delayed Keystone XL pipeline. The fate of Keystone, you'll remember, was an ongoing skirmish between environmentalists and big oil for most of the Obama administration. But given market realities right now, oil market realities, we could well be deep into the Trump administration before Keystone gets built. Marketplace's Adam Allington has the story.
Canadian pipelines today are almost at capacity. So even though oil is trading cheaper today than it was 8 years ago, there's still demand, which should be good news for backers of the Keystone pipeline.
But here's the rub. The issue is that this isn't going to open tomorrow, even though it's getting its permit.
Sandy Fielden is director of research for commodities and energy at Morningstar. By the time Keystone's up and running, oil companies might not be looking to Canada.
Producers are now looking at shorter term projects like domestic shale. So if we go after about 2020, then production in Western Canada starts to decline.
In 2009, there was lots of talk about peak oil, which turned out not to be the case. Energy economist Philip Verleger says the question now turns not on approval to build, but who's going to pay for it?
The companies extracting the oil may have to front all the costs for this.
And whether they'll pay is far from certain, he says, especially since construction will cost billions of dollars and companies can place cheaper bets on shale oil and fracking. So
my guess is this pipeline never gets built.
Verleger says the project still faces hurdles with property owners in other states, but Sabrina Fang with the American Petroleum Institute says the fact that TransCanada is pushing for permits is a sign they think it's profitable.
TransCanada seems very determined to build this pipeline. So I would say that this pipeline will be built. It's just taken 8 years to get the permit to build it.
Environmental groups are already pledging to work to block the pipeline's construction. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
The world's biggest entertainment conglomerate is taking its sweet old time finding a new CEO. Disney is going to extend incumbent CEO Bob Iger's contract for another year till 2019 is when this one expires. It's the third extension Iger has gotten. It comes with a $5 million bonus, which is nice for Iger. But Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains now why succession can be such a tough issue for such big companies.
For Disney, the process is particularly hard. That's according to Robin Diedrich, an Edward Jones senior equity analyst following the company.
Disney is a very complicated company in the sense that there are three or four businesses that are very different. It's obviously a very high-profile company and has done extremely well.
Disney's board likes what Robert Iger has done at the company, so is in no rush to have him go. But succession planning is rough for big corporations in general. Thomas Leese is a professor emeritus at the Kellogg School.
There's a catch-22. Ideally, they would want to hire somebody internally because there's more information about such a person.
But if that doesn't work out, you have to go outside the company, which has its own set of challenges.
And you're particularly afraid that you make an offer to somebody whom you think is very good, and then their company doesn't match. In fact, they may be quite happy he was taken off their books.
And who wants a CEO no one else wants? Another factor, sitting CEOs that Jeffrey Sonnenfeld at Yale calls monarchs.
The way you can tell if you have that, it's not just deferred succession, but are they destroying platoons of potential successors in the pipeline?
Sonnenfeld says Disney's Iger is definitely not that type. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We're going to do two more segments today to wrap up our series on NAFTA that we've been doing this week. A big picture interview in just a bit, but first, cars. And one of the underpinnings of the North American Free Trade Agreement, the idea that the whole point of the thing was that the economic whole is more than just the sum of the parts. With cars, quite literally. Marketplace's Scott Tong went to Ann Arbor, Michigan to get the story.
In the course of production, the inside parts of your car very often visit Canada and or Mexico and then return. In fact, they've often been called industrial tourists. You know, go over, connect to another part, buy a bad t-shirt, come back. Well, it turns out the average part accumulates 8 bad t-shirts along the way. To explain all this, Dave Andrea at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan, takes the wheel of a 2014 Honda CR-V.
You have the company making the leather, the company that's providing the thread and the stitching is different. Behind that is the rim. The airbag is sourced from another supplier.
The specifics of supplier relationships are often secret, but it's a safe bet that the metal rim of your steering wheel, when it's still bare and naked, travels south to get stitched and covered, because that's low-end manual work.
That would need to be shipped to Mexico for the covering to be put on top of that and stitched. That part then could come back as an assembly.
To then get connected to the steering wheel buttons and lights, etc. Dave Andrea then starts the CR-V, and he looks under the hood. He explains the spark plug connects to wires that go into a kind of wiring headquarters. It's called a harness. And those harnesses also come from plants in Mexico. He visited one of them, and he saw it had a world map of all the pieces coming and going.
It looked like one of the airline charts out of the back of the airline magazines, where you have the hub and spoke system.
Often the hubs are in southern Mexico, Ontario, and Michigan, which helps explain the constant truck traffic across Michigan's Ambassador Bridge going in and out of Canada. Effectively, this is Team North America in the auto sector, competing against Team Europe and Team Asia. All this supply chain globalization really started to take off in the early 90s, right around when NAFTA came.
The real increase in the pace of technical change was only kicking in around that time.
Economist Mike Smitka at Washington and Lee University in Virginia says in the early NAFTA days, U.S. automakers were getting out of the business of making parts. In over two decades, the supply chain exploded like an atom. Companies went everywhere, including Mexico, for cheap labor.
This is people with relatively modest skill levels standing at a pegboard, putting wires up and over pegs, and then pulling out tape, very fancy tape, and then bundling them together.
The push to lower costs has kept vehicles affordable. In fact, prices, adjusted for fancy upgrades and stuff, have stayed pretty much flat since the 90s. Smitka calls the NAFTA integration nearshoring, keeping jobs close in North America. But all that takes smooth passage across borders.
This border crossing is people, it's physical goods, and being able to do it in a hassle-free manner.
To be sure, all this has allowed some jobs to leave the U.S. auto sector, for Canada and for Mexico. But others will stay. Ann Arbor, Michigan's Heinz Industries makes high-end testing machines for car companies. The CEO, Dawn Heinz, buys some of her own parts from overseas. Though these days, she's not even sure where they're from.
We have a lot of parts that are imported from Germany. They say Germany, but they could have been manufactured at the Mexican plant of Bosch and then sent to us.
But her machines and production are staying right here in the industrial Midwest. They require precision and experience and engineering. And those don't travel very well.
Yes, there are balancing machine companies that are cropping up in a number of developing countries. Do the major auto suppliers buy them? No, they don't, because they don't have the reliability and the brand recognition.
So, even if your car was assembled in Mexico, a good portion of the content is likely from the States. Take this 2014 Honda CR-V. The, quote, Mexico-made version is, by one estimate, 68% American. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we knew it was beloved, but boy, we didn't know how beloved it was.
Remaking classic movies can be a beast. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 59 points today, 0.3%, closed at 20,596. NASDAQ up 11 points, about 0.2%, 58.28. S&P 500 shed a point, less than 0.1%, 23.43 there. For the week, the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 1.5%. NASDAQ slipped 1.2%. S&P 500 gave back 1.4%. That is all pretty much that bad day, Tuesday, Wednesday-ish. Chipmaker Micron Technology jumped 7.4% today after its second quarter earnings beat expectations. Western Digital gained 2.6%. SeaWorld Entertainment splashed up 4.75% today after a Chinese real estate group bought a 21% stake in the company from the Blackstone Investment Group. Bonds rose just a bit. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.41%. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about all the things we talk about on this program every single day,
technology, the economy, pop culture, politics, check out our podcast, Make Me Smart.
Molly Wood is my co-host.
Or maybe Kai Rizdahl is my co-host.
I don't know. Maybe. We've got new episodes every week.
And we have live Facebook videos and all kinds of other great stuff for you.
Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts.
And please follow us on Twitter for more. I am at Molly Wood.
And I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Check it out. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so we've done the history of NAFTA this week. We've asked business owners and workers and trade negotiators what they think about it. Today, to wrap things up, a political economist. Mark Melitz is a professor of political economy at Harvard University. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What, in your mind, is the biggest thing that people get wrong when they talk about NAFTA?
I guess I would say that people do not understand how trade agreements such as NAFTA can generate gains for all of the countries involved. And so that it's been a good thing for the U.S. as well as for our partners in Mexico and Canada.
Well, explain that a little bit, because, you know, you go out in this country and you talk to enough people and the overwhelming viewpoint of NAFTA is negative, that it has cost jobs and lowered wages.
Exactly.
And all of that stuff that I'm sure you've heard on and on again.
Exactly. The focus tends to be on a job that can be somehow tied to being lost because of NAFTA. But we don't pay anywhere near as much attention to all of the jobs that are created because of NAFTA. And so in the end, the analysis will show that there is very little effect on overall employment from a trade agreement such as NAFTA, but the perception remains that it has been a huge job killer.
Right.
Another part of it is just that the job losses are much more concentrated, and so they're much more visible, they're much more salient. The pain associated with that is real, so we tend to focus on that side of the effects.
Let's venture into the hypothetical here for just a second. And let's say President Trump either successfully renegotiates or pulls the United States out of NAFTA. Would the people who have been on the losing end of that deal still be on the losing end of the American economy?
So I'm afraid that the answer would be yes. U.S. manufacturing jobs have seen a steady decline starting in 1960 by a couple percentage points a year. This happened way before NAFTA, way before there's been a huge wave of imports from China. Automation is one big part of that. And so it's hard to see that had NAFTA not been in place, or if we significantly abridged NAFTA now, that is going to bring back many of those manufacturing jobs. Most likely what would happen is it would divert the pattern of trade away from trade from Mexico and with other countries.
Well, let me follow up on something you just alluded to. What would the American economy look like if NAFTA had never been born?
Sure. The effect on the U.S. economy would be that prices would be higher. Consumers can enjoy lower prices for goods that are imported from Mexico. And firms would be less efficient because NAFTA has allowed supply chains to be streamlined and consolidated across the whole North American continent. And yes, we would have maybe a few more jobs in certain manufacturing sectors, but we would have lost the opportunity to grow some other sectors, some of them in manufacturing and a lot of them in services such as in engineering and in R&D and in marketing.
What's your guess then as to what happens with the president's promises?
Oh, I have no idea. that seems to change by the day, by the week. I don't feel like I have enough information to answer that.
Mark Mellitz is a professor of political economy at Harvard University. Professor, thanks very much for your time.
Sure, absolutely.
I know the new Power Rangers movie is coming out today and all, but I don't think we are quite done yet talking about the other crazily popular 1990s reboot in theaters right now, Beauty and the Beast, and however many box office records this thing has been setting since it opened last week. Good news for Disney, of course, and its now extended CEO Bob Iger, as we talked about earlier, but also for the company that actually produced the movie, Mandeville Films is that company, where Todd Lieberman and David Hoberman are in charge. Todd Lieberman, thanks so much for coming to the studio for us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
How did it come to pass that you and your colleagues at Mandeville were the people that Disney said, yes, please do this ginormous movie for us?
Well, it's one of those stories, I guess, that you can kind of trace back several years ago.
Like nine. I mean, this thing's
9 years
forever.
Ago. Yeah, we had the idea a long time ago to do, frankly, a movie about the Beast. Had several drafts of that done, and then Frozen came out. And Disney knows their brand better than anybody,
yeah.
And they're kind of geniuses across the board. And Alan Horn and Sean Bailey called and said, you know, what do you guys think about taking this and going back to the beloved 1991 film and kind of doing that with the available technology now? So it was their idea. And they were right.
Okay, but that phrase, beloved 1991 film, yeah. Therein lies peril.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And when we say the beloved 1991 film, we knew it was beloved, but boy, we didn't know how beloved it was. And that movie is revered.
Did Bob Iger, when this deal got signed or whatever Hollywood does when a deal, green light, right? When it got green lighted. Did Bob Iger sit you down and say, listen, don't blow this?
No.
really? Come on.
No, there. Look, I mean, there's no overt pressure of if you guys don't do this,
right.
Then XYZ. It's kind of inherent in the pressures on all of us, including them. We all feel the same pressure, and we put it on ourselves rather than having to have someone put it upon us.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me for a second about the choices you made to diverge, I guess, from the original, right? The Belle backstory and a little bit more about why the Beast or the Prince or whatever he's properly referred to is, in fact, the way he is.
We all collectively wanted to make sure that this story was fleshed out more so than would may have been allowed or normal in an animated film. So there was always a question in fans of the film of what happened to Belle's mom. And we figured that was probably a good question to answer. And that's really the tricky balance in this thing, is not changing the original film that people revere to the degree that they do so much that it doesn't feel like that movie, but at the same time giving people enough more candy and emotion to kind of latch on to justify it being made.
Along those lines, acknowledging that you've been at Disney now for a long time,
yeah.
you and David, are you guys now made men at Disney with this smash runaway hit?
That's not a question I could answer, really. But I'll say I don't think there's anything but joy coming out of this experience from anybody. You know, I've had the fortunate, I was fortunate to come into a scenario with David 18 years ago where I think he probably was already a made man because he had run the studio. So I kind of drafted off that goodwill. But yeah, as it stands right now, I would imagine everybody's pretty happy.
Todd Lieberman with his colleague, his partner, David Hoberman, they produced Beauty and the Beast for Disney. Todd, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which some Democratic members of the United States Senate are trolling the President of the United States. There has been some back and forth in Washington that you might not have heard of. It's over visitor logs, the official records of who goes to see whom, not only at the White House, but now also at the president's personal properties at Trump Tower and Mar-a-Lago. The Trump administration has been silent on whether it's going to continue the recent practice of releasing those logs. So today, the Make Access Records Available to Lead American Government Openness Act was introduced. The Make Access Records Available to Lead American Government Openness Act. You get it? Mar-a-Lago, right? Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around here. I'm Kai Rizal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.